Well, this evening we're going to have under consideration chapter 9 of Deuteronomy, as Logan read. We appreciate that. And Deuteronomy 9 is a bit of a shift from what we've been going through thus far in the book of Deuteronomy. So far there have been exhortations against Israel losing their faith, against getting into the land and forgetting God, turning to idols, not having enough faith to conquer the peoples. And this is a little bit of a twist in chapter 9 because it's more of a warning against self-righteousness, against pride. Keel and DeLitch had a good thought on this, paraphrasing. They say that there's a pride that forgets God altogether and his blessings, and that's what's been discussed before in the book of Deuteronomy. But there's also a more insidious pride, which holds that blessings are earned or deserved because of unrighteousness, because of things we've done. This previous, again, has been focusing more on that, and we're going to focus on this self-righteousness that Israel was warned against in this chapter. Verse 24 sort of sets the tone, I think, for at least a good portion of chapter 9, this idea that Israel's been rebellious against the Lord this entire time. Moses says, from the day that I knew you. So certainly nothing, at least in Moses' experience with Israel, would have been merited them being able to enter the promised land, if I can say it like that. So this is a warning by Moses to take stock of where you're at. Don't be filled with this self-righteousness and pride. You're going to enter Canaan in spite of all the things that you've done, all the attitudes you've shown, the rebellion that you've manifested over and over, not because of some self-worth of yours. And certainly this is a great chapter for us to apply in that same sense. None of us have done anything to deserve heaven or salvation, but we've been given that opportunity. And if we take advantage of that, we can enter into that covenant as well today. So without any other things to say, let's just jump right in question one. Let's see. This one will be for you. What did the righteousness of the people of Israel have to do with their conquering Canaan?
Well, simply put, it had nothing to do with their righteousness. Verse 6, they were a stiff-necked people. John chapter 15 and verse 4 mentions that, for without me you can do nothing. Philippians 4 and verse 13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. This process was going to be a partnership, Israel and God. Similar to us today, really. We have a part to do. God's made a way, a plan, and we have a part to do it. It's a partnership. Israel worked with God to take over Canaan. Today we're also working with God. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 1. We then, as workers together with him also, plead with you not to receive the grace of God in vain.
I apologize. I guess I got into question one a little bit in the introduction. Who wants to add to that? Bart?
Yeah, I appreciate what Bill said, and obviously, this is a warning against pride and haughtiness, and many themes in the New Testament, as Bill pointed out, that reiterate the same idea. James, I love the book of James and how it warns us not to be haughty. God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble, James 4, verse 6. Humble yourselves before the Lord and he will lift you up, 4, verse 10. Philippians 2, verse 3, in humility value others above yourself. But perhaps the most applicable is Romans, the book of Romans. God, Paul, the Roman writer, compares the Jews as the natural branch and Christianity, the Gentiles, as the wild branch. And he warns that if you're haughty, just as the natural branch has been broken off, you too shall be broken off. So I wanted to read a few of those verses. If some of the branches were broken off, and you being a wild olive tree were grafted in among them, and with them became a partaker of the root and fatness of the olive tree, do not boast against the branches. But if you do boast, remember that you do not support the root, but the root supports you. You will say then, branches were broken off, that I may be grafted in. Well said, because of unbelief they were broken off, and you stand by faith. Do not be haughty, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, he may not spare you either. So I think there's an exact replication. The Israelites are warned, don't be haughty. This is not because of anything you did. And the same warning is given to us.
Yeah, very appreciate that. I find it interesting, too, in verses 1 and 2, Moses repeats some of the exact phrases, the rebellious phrases that Israel had uttered previously. It's recorded in Deuteronomy 1, but also back in the book of Numbers when the spies were sent out. They said these same things. The cities are great, and they're fortified up to heaven. The people are gigantic. So Moses is turning these words back around on the people of Israel. And it's interesting to wonder why, perhaps. Perhaps just to remind the people, you know, this is how you felt not so long ago. You're going to overcome in spite of it. Perhaps just to inspire their faith that even because of this, you know, you, if you have faith, will be able to overcome that. But it's interesting that these words that Israel had uttered in rebellion in the past are now used sort of as a rallying cry for the people before going into Canaan. Lord?
Well, it wasn't about their righteousness, but it was because of the wickedness of the Canaanites. You see this in verse 4. Of the wickedness of these nations, the Lord is driving them out before you. And one of the commentators also pointed to a verse which I thought was pretty interesting. A righteous nation was not a prerequisite to being used as a conquering people. He pointed to Isaiah 7:20. In the same day, the Lord will shave with a hired razor with those from beyond the river, with the king of Assyria, the head of the hair, the head and the hair of the legs, and will also remove the beard. This, you know, talking about the Assyrians conquering Israel, and the Assyrians were exceedingly wicked.
Just as an extra tidbit here, really regarding Israel's lack of righteousness here and their sense of rebellion throughout this chapter, there's seven different qualities that are mentioned regarding their rebelliousness in this chapter alone. It's one, they are stiff-necked, as we see in verse 6 and 13, rebellious. Verse 7, 23 and 24, they corrupted themselves. Verse 12, they provoked God to wrath. Verse 7 and 22, they believed not unto God. Verse 23, they sinned and were evil. And verse 18, and they quickly turned aside from God. So just as an extra tidbit there.
Grant?
Just real quick, John. So I was really interesting how I mentioned three times here in a row, not because of your righteousness, not because of your righteousness, not because of your righteousness, versus four or five, like, right after each other, whenever you
do that. And again, it stands as a warning to them in the past and for us today, all of them coming. Anyone else? A couple small things that I thought were interesting on this section. In verse 1, it says, "Hear, O Israel, you're to cross over the Jordan today." And from what I could read, this word that's translated today means this day, or it may mean, it's meaning soon, imminently, but not necessarily today in the way we would think of it. So, for instance, I don't know if the rest of the book of Deuteronomy was given all in one day, and then right after that Israel crossed over. The point is, this is imminent. It's happening very, very soon. And then I mentioned in verses 1 and 2 that the words that Israel had uttered, the spies, had come back with this bad report. The city's large, walled, and well-defended. Jameson Fawcett Brown, I think it was, mentioned that the walls of some of these cities in this region were something on the order of 40 feet high. You know, this was the sort of thing that would have been impossible physically. We've talked about it before, but this is something Israel could have not physically done. They weren't experienced enough. They didn't have the weapons, the supply. This was not something they could have done. Prevailed over the people of the land. I was trying to come up with a concrete way to imagine the faith that it would have taken Israel to do this, because it's sort of a foreign concept to us to try to overrun, you know, a city with giant walls. The closest thing I could think of is something on the order of, if someone told you to go to Washington, D.C., and I want you to walk right into the Pentagon, you know, take some papers, come back out, you know, just walk right in. And all of us would think that's a death mission. You're at the very least going to get assaulted, arrested, and probably shot. That flies in the face of so much common sense that you would walk through security guards and borders and barbed wire fences and people with weapons. But that's basically what Israel was being asked to do, to go on, for what all intents and purposes for us is a suicide mission, try to fight against these walled cities, these giant people with superior weapons, warfare, knowledge of warfare. But yeah, that's what they were called to do. And so it was sort of putting aside, it's easy for us, I think, sometimes to wonder how they didn't have enough faith, or the faith to completely remove all the peoples of the land. And it's amazing what they were able to do, but I think sometimes that gets lost, the amount of faith and how counterintuitive that would have been to attack these cities that have been there for centuries, probably, in some cases. And then one more thing in verse 5, mentions two aspects, righteousness and uprightness of heart. So some commentators speculate that righteousness is here referring to obedience to the law, action, more of an active sense, and uprightness of heart being more inward thoughts, attitudes. Psalm 15, verses 1 and 2, who will stand before the Lord, I think is that passage. You have to be, in order to be pleasing to God, you have to have both these qualities. But as Grant mentioned, Moses is saying here, both of these qualities, even if you have both, that in and of itself isn't going to get you into the promised land. That is not merit enough for you to enter in. It's because of, as was said, the wickedness of the people and also the covenant that had been made with Abraham long ago. Anything else? Okay. Question two then, Hunter. This will be for you. Why did Moses fast during 40 years, or days, rather, he spent on the mountain with the Lord? And what is the general purpose of fasting?
Well, as to why he focused, or why he fasted, sorry, the first time for the 40 days, there's not a specific reason mentioned. I'd like to think it was that he was focused on God and all the holiness that he was surrounded by, and I don't know if many people who would really have any desire to eat when you're in the presence of the Lord. And then in verse 18, we do get a reason in regards to the second time why he fasted, and that was to obtain a complete restitution of the covenant which the children of Israel had just broken due to their apostasy, and it was to, for the people's sins and to avert God's wrath was why he fasted. As far as the general purpose of fasting, and I guess in the most generic sense, it's to commit oneself really entirely or as much as possible to God and to focus, meditate on some sort of spiritual issue and to seek God's guidance in it. It's an act of self-control, and it displays a reliance on God. You know, you look at Luke 4, we see Jesus fasting 40 days in the wilderness, focusing on the Lord, and Mark 9:29, where the apostles ask Christ, why come we can cast out these demons? Because they don't come out with prayer and fasting. So there's multiple reasons for fasting. But it generally revolves around three principles, either mourning, lamentation, or some sort of petition unto God.
Good. As an aside for this section, in verse 9, that phrase starting at, then I stayed on the mountain 40 days, all the way till the end of that verse, neither ate bread nor drank water, that's parenthetical in the original text, as I understand it. So this is put it in parentheses, so you could read this as, when I went up into the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant which the Lord made with you, then the Lord delivered to me, in verse 10. That statement is about the fasting is made to be parenthetical. So the idea, as I understand it here, is that Moses isn't making a point with the fasting or trying to brag about this, look at what I was doing on the mountain. Moses was the most humble man, but Moses is giving this as an aside, the way it's written in the Hebrew text. And I think Hunter's right in a sense, this is contrasting with the people. You know, Moses, I'm on the mountain, and yeah, I was fasting while I was there. And the connotation being, you, meanwhile, are in the camp and you're starting this idol worship up that I'm gonna have to come down and break up. So there's a contrast there at play, and I believe that's the main purpose. A couple small things. Verse 7, Moses says, from the day that you departed from the land of Egypt until you came to this place, you've been rebellious against the Lord. That might be referring to, certainly they were rebellious in Egypt. We'll get to that a little bit later, but Israel rejected Moses before he left Egypt the first time and then came back later, but also before Israel even crossed over the Red Sea. In Exodus 14:11, they rebelled against the Lord and against Moses' leading, and this continued up until this day. And then in verse 8, it reads in the New King James also in Horeb, but this is better rendered as even in Horeb. So again, within this phrase, there's this idea of you're in Horeb in the presence of God, so I expected you, God expected you to behave there. If there was anywhere you would refrain from rebelling, sinning against the Lord, you would think it would be in his presence in the manifestation or the manifested physical presence of God, but even then, even in Horeb, you rebelled against the Lord. And then, of course, that's referring to the golden calf in Exodus 32. Pardon?
This made me think of Stephen. So Stephen, of course, is at the beginning of the church. And as you said, they're standing in the these individuals are standing at Sinai and they've been through all the miracles and they've been given the covenant. Thus, the Jews in the first century have seen all the miracles and they've seen the Lord himself. And as you mentioned, the word stiff-necked people, and you, in verse 7, you provoke the Lord to wrath from this, from that day until you came to this place. And then listen to what Stephen says, how similar. It had to ring in their ears. He says, you stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit as your fathers did. That's Acts 7:51. As your fathers did, so do you. And so it's almost like Stephen is channeling that idea. Here you are at the beginning of this new covenant, and yet you're resisting the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm. And Moses repeats almost the same thing in, let's see, question number 5. We talk about that again.
The verse you mentioned, verse 8, also in Horeb, you provoked the Lord to wrath so that the Lord was angry enough with you to destroy you. Keep in mind, while Moses is up on the mountain with the Lord for the 40 days, I mean, there's fire and I suppose lightnings and thundering going on while the children of Israel are down making this golden calf, as you pointed out. So while they're doing that, there is visible sign of the presence of the Lord.
Yeah, I think it's really powerful to consider that verse in that sense, even in Horeb. Yeah, just to think about. And certainly we do the same thing sometimes. Anyone else? Okay. Sam? Okay. Trace, this one will be for you. Question 3, what was God going to do to the people after the golden calf incident, and how did Moses intercede?
Well, as we all can remember in Exodus, according to Exodus chapter 32, in Psalms chapter 9, verse 5, and chapter 109, verse 13, all refers to this event where God had every intention of destroying all of Israel. He wanted to start over new with Moses, and who could blame him? Those were his people, and without touching on the very last point in these questions, thankfully Moses brought to light the right stuff to make God change his mind, and well, he didn't make him change his mind, but God changed his mind out of love and being forgiving, of course. But yeah, he had every intention of destroying all of Israel because, Aaron had helped form the golden calf, and that was to be his high priest. And I mean, there's so much awfulness going on. And, of course, Moses begged God to forgive them, and so God forgave them in Exodus 32, verse 11 and 14, and in Psalms 106, verse 23 also.
Very good. That's a very difficult thing for us to try to comprehend, the idea of convincing God. Verse 14, in the New King James, it says, let me alone. But literally, God is saying, desist from me, depart from me. Don't try to change my mind. And Moses does it anyway, Exodus 32:10. And so why God listens to Moses is sort of an interesting thing to think about. And then Moses, in this passage here, leaves out the intercession he made on the people's behalf. In Exodus 32:11, he specifies, I talked to God on your behalf. Here he doesn't say that. Perhaps an indication of the humility of Moses. And the same way with Aaron. Aaron hasn't been mentioned previously, but in this section it says specifically that Moses interceded for Aaron as well, because certainly Aaron would have been the most culpable for this. So there's a lot of interesting stuff contained in these few verses. Matt?
In verse 21, Moses says, he talks about how he burned down the calf and then threw all of the dust from the gold into the river or the brook. And I just thought about a few weeks ago when we studied chapter 7, God was telling them, when you go into Canaan and you find these idols made of silver and gold, you're not to keep that silver, you're not to covet that, because even though you're not going to worship that idol, or you say you're not going to worship that idol, you coveting the silver and gold therein is in itself idolatry. So Moses is being consistent with that idea here in this story when he gets rid of all of that gold. Because even though it wasn't the calf that they were worshiping anymore, it still represented their idolatrous practice.
Yeah, very good. Verse 21, I think, is one of the more interesting verses I remember coming across in our study so far in the Old Testament. I think there's a lot contained in that verse, specifically the start. I took your sin. You know, that's a very powerful phrase. Moses is saying, I took that as a physical manifestation of your sin. I destroyed it. I cast it into the brook that was descending from the mountain that you used to stay alive, to water yourself. And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, I couldn't find anybody else that made this connection, but they connect this brook that's mentioned in verse 21 to the smitten rock of Exodus 17 with the idea that this brook from Mount Sinai was the headwaters, if you will, and then it manifested later in the rock in Exodus 17, but this brook being connected to that. And so the idea of, as Matt said, the powders from this idol, this sin, and that word sin carries with it the ideas of the sin offering, the guilt aspect of sin under the old law. This was cast into the brook so that there'd be no remembrance of it. It's at least part of that, to dispose of that sin. So in a very literal sense for Israel, their sin was washed away. That's a concept I had never really thought about with this, but I mean, that's what Moses is saying happened here. And if you can connect this to the smitten rock, and that rock being Christ, 1 Corinthians 10:4, then there's a perfect type for us in that idea of sin being washed away in his blood. And then the people drinking of the brook, we also drink of the blood of Christ, again, if you can make that connection, just as Israel had to drink that bitter sin water from the book. So there's a lot within this verse that you can potentially dig out and make some really interesting type connections. And then one small thing, again, within this section, I had never thought about it, but a couple commentators pointed out the idea of Moses breaking these tablets wasn't necessarily just out of anger or frustration, but it was a symbol of the covenant being broken, that Israel had already, while the ink was still fresh, so to speak, broken the covenant and had to be renewed. Anything else? Okay. Question four, then. Sure. Dennis, this one will be for you. What events transpired at Taberah, Massa, and Kibroth Hattaavah?
In short, they provoked the Lord to wrath and caused his anger to burn hot against them. The first one, Numbers 11:3, they complained to the Lord. The fire of the Lord went out and consumed some of them. Second, Exodus 17:7, there's no water. And they said, is the Lord among us or not? They were, you know, questioning the Lord, the loyalty of the Lord. And so that angered him. And then Numbers 11:3, and then also 34 is that incident about craving the meat. And so how he dealt with that, and the ones that gave into the craving, verse 34, were buried there.
Yeah, that's very good. And what's that? Matt?
A lot of contemporary scholars, that when they see that Taberah and Kibroth Hattaavah are listed as separate events here in this account, they begin to jump to the conclusion that Deuteronomy was written well after the rest of the Mosaic books were, because Moses in Numbers says that they're the same, or whoever wrote Numbers says that they're the same, they happen on the same plane, same place, basically, one after another. And then the writer of Deuteronomy says they're two separate events, but they were two separate events. They didn't necessarily have to be two separate places here. Dennis said that the first one, they complained about a different thing, and then they complained about the food in Numbers chapter 11. So just listing these two as different events does not disqualify Moses from writing both books, as some people jump to that conclusion.
Yeah. These also, as you mentioned, aren't chronological. These two seem to be from the same chapter. And so they're given, some commentators speculated that the rebellions given are here in increasing order of severity. And then, of course, we culminate in the golden calf. Well, I guess we already were at the golden calf, but then we get back into more of the rebellion. So we can speculate why they're written the way they are, but as you mentioned, there's not this conflict there. don't have anything else on that one. So question number five, let's see, Matt, this one will be for you then. What does the phrase, you've been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you, mean? And to what Moses, to what might Moses be referring?
There's a lot of ways that I thought this question could go. What I ended up deciding was that it'd be, you've been rebellious against the Lord from the beginning, from, you know, since I met these people, since I came in contact with these people. That's the best guess that I could figure out. And to what he's referring to, there were several events at the onset of Moses' leadership that it could have been. I just went to the very first one, which is right after Moses and Aaron tell Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go, and then Pharaoh kind of cracks down on them, tells them to work harder, and then begins to abuse them. And in verse 21 of Exodus chapter 5, the Israelite men say to Moses, "Let the Lord look on you and judge you, because you've made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us." So that's the first time that Israel complains against Moses, complains against God. It could have gone, this question could go a lot of ways, but I just kind of went to the very first time.
One, I mentioned earlier, so a little bit after Matt's incident, but I mentioned earlier in Exodus 14, verse 11, Israel has been delivered. I was going to think from that sense, once they've been delivered, they don't even get past the Red Sea before they already, in Exodus 14, 11, cry to go back, and they're going to get swallowed up. And so really, they weren't even delivered before they started complaining. And then if no one else has anything, the earliest one I could think of was actually in Exodus chapter 2, verse 14, when Moses kills the Egyptian man who's abusing a fellow Israelite, and Israel, instead of embracing that and embracing Moses as a deliverer, they reject him right then and there. Who made, I don't remember the specific phrase used, but from the very beginning, Moses' first act in defense, in aid of Israel, was met with rejection by the people. And as has been mentioned, certainly it was downhill from there in many senses. Anyone want to add to that? I've already turned over. So in Exodus 2:14, the Israelite man, after Moses kills the Egyptian, says, "He said, 'Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?' So Moses feared and said, 'Surely this thing is known.'" And then Moses flees Egypt, and Israel leaves Israel in Egypt until he comes back later. But as has been mentioned, there were unfortunately almost constant acts of rebellion, some more egregious than others, that Israel perpetrated. Grant?
If you go back to Exodus 15, after they've left, of course they sing this wonderful song about God, how he saved them after these hundreds of years being in captivity. And then in verse 22 there, it says, after 3 days during the wilderness, just 3 days, they're already complaining.
Yeah, there you go. This is the first maybe after deliverance over the Red Sea. Anyone else? Okay. Final question then, Grant. This one will be for you. Question six, how was Moses concerned about the way people might view God?
I thought the question was a little strangely worded. I kind of answered a little bit of a different question. That's right. The question I answered was, what was Moses' concern about how God was going to deal with his people? Which I said that Moses was very concerned about how the people, the other nations, would view the destruction of the people after they've been pulled out of Israel. And of course, it's ridiculous to think that God could bring Israel out of Egypt with such miraculous events that he couldn't actually bring them to another land. But Moses was very concerned about how people would actually view the final steps of what would be the final conclusion to the nation if they were destroyed there in the wilderness, that God just wasn't strong enough even then. And Moses, of course, goes on to have people, as we've already mentioned, that he is allowed to intervene for Israel there and convince God otherwise. And he was very concerned about how people would view God.
This scenario is interesting to me because it seems like Moses is kind of saying this in spite of the Israelites, but at the same time, his plea to God also helps the Israelites. So he's kind of saying, well, if you don't do this, then these people aren't going to think These people are right, basically. All of this time that they've been complaining against me, complaining against you, they're just going to say, you know what? See, we were right the whole time. So if you do that, if you deliver them, you prove them wrong, even though it helps them ultimately in getting to the promised land. So I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, that's a tough thing because they were proven wrong eventually, you know. Anyway, so that's one of those interesting things to wonder. God would have been right either way. That's the conclusion we have to draw. I don't think he was swayed necessarily by Moses' argument, but he gives it credence. Anyone else? Laura?
Verse 28, Moses makes the argument that they would say he hated them and has brought them out to kill them in the wilderness. It's kind of a similar argument a lot of people today use about God when they read the Old Testament as a ruthless, you know, point to God as somebody who promotes genocide and so forth.
Yeah, that's kind of true. Think about it that way. Anyone else? One interesting thing I think about this section is that verse 25, it's easy to sort of forget the way this is structured, but verse 25 is referring back to Sinai. So we've had a little break in the middle where we talked about other rebellions. And then now we're going back to Sinai, Exodus 32, verses 11 to 13. Very similar words are used. And in this discussion of Sinai, you know, we've had a little pause. Now we're back to it. And it even continues into chapter 10. So we had a little brief intermission, and then Sinai is the subject of the rest of this chapter, but also I think the first 10 or 11 verses of the next chapter. And throughout chapter 9, Moses has recalled over and over, and really throughout the book of Deuteronomy, over and over, Moses has recalled the places, the times, and the occasions of Israel's rebellion, Israel's backbiting, Israel's fist shaking at God on an attempt to humble the people. Sort of summarize this, anyone has anything else. Again, in the past, it's been, if you were rebellious in the past, when you get into Canaan, don't do it again. Don't turn away from God. Don't turn to idols. Go down that path. And yet here's the opposite instruction. Don't turn down the other path and think that you have some, you know, that you, out of some might, some power that you have, were able to do these things. It was God. And so the whole point, really, of the book of Deuteronomy is to maintain that proper relationship to God, that faith and trust and covenant relationship in God, in order to keep those blessings, to keep the land that they've been given. Unfortunately, we know that didn't last.